Topic of the shiur is halachic loopholes. And I think one of the questions that we often hear is, why can't the rabbis create a loophole to allow something that is viewed as a pressing need in today's society? For example, the question is, why can't we create a halachic loophole to free agunot? Why can't we create a loophole to allow kohanim to marry divorcees? Why can't we provide a loophole to allow for greater opportunities for women's spiritual leadership? The rabbis found ways for us to lend money with interest to other Jews, even though that seems to be prohibited by the Torah. And the rabbis have found ways to ensure that Shemitah does not cancel out loans. So why can't they come up with loopholes for the pressing needs of 2021? So first, I'm going to provide two different approaches to explain in general when loopholes are recommended and when loopholes are not recommended. I'm going to apply the rationales of these approaches to a number of common halachic loopholes, and then I'm going to add one important caveat, and then explain how we would apply this analysis to some of the contemporary current issues of today, where there seems to be a demand or a strong request for halachic loopholes. So what is a loophole? So Black's Law Dictionary defines a loophole as an ambiguity, an omission, or exception that provides a way to avoid a rule without violating its literal requirements. Now, Chazal were not happy with all loopholes. So for example, in Maseches Brachos, Daf Lamed Hei Amud Beis, the Gemara states that whereas earlier generations would bring in their produce by way of the front door in order to make it obligated in Maaser and tithing, later generations would bring their produce by way of the roofs, the yards, or the other enclosures, but not directly into the house by the door, in order to exempt the produce from Maaser. There's a pasuk which basically says it has to come in through the door. If it, let's say, comes in through the roof, then you're not chayv in Maaser. So clearly this statement reflects the negative attitude of Chazal towards the moral legitimacy of later generations who would avail themselves of these loopholes. So now, why do Chazal frown upon, let's say, this loophole, but they are supportive of other loopholes? Rav Herschel Schachter, in his Sefer Ikvei Tzon, Simon Tezvav, suggests that we frown upon a loophole if it's created to avoid being mekayim a mitzvah saseh. If it's simply a bittul mitzvah saseh, if it allows us to avoid a mitzvah saseh, so then we don't like that loophole. If it's to avoid a prohibition, an iser, then that is certainly okay. In other words, if I have an opportunity to perform a mitzvah and I employ a loophole so that I don't perform the mitzvah, then that's not a good thing. That's why the Gemara frowns upon me bringing my produce through the roof of my house, because in doing so, I am exempting myself from performing a mitzvah. But Moshe Lichtenstein wrote an article about Ha'arama, about the halachic loophole in halacha, and there he wrote that observance of the mitzvos is not just a command and an assignment, but also a favor that HaKadosh Baruch Hu performs for his creatures. In other words, the mitzvos are an expression of Hashem's love for his creations and his desire to fill them with merit. Why would we then want to engage in a loophole to exempt ourselves from such an opportunity? It's like someone saying, you know, I don't want to wash for bread. I'm sorry, I don't want to eat bread. Why? Because if I eat bread, I'll have to wash and I'll have to bench. Why would we want to do that? Halacha would frown upon that. Halacha would say that we should want to do mitzvah saseh. We should want to take advantage of these spiritual opportunities. However, says Rav Schachter, if the purpose of the halachic loophole is simply to avoid violating an iser, a prohibition, then that is an acceptable loophole. Rabbi J.D. Bleich wrote an article in the sixth volume of Contemporary Halachic Problems, and there he makes a little bit of a different distinction between when halacha frowns upon halachic loopholes and when halacha is supportive of halachic loopholes. He makes a distinction as to whether the reason for the loophole is legitimate and desirable or whether it's not. So, for example, the purpose of separating Maaser is to provide a livelihood for the Levim who are required to serve in the Beis HaMikdash and to teach the nation. If there is no Maaser, so the Levim would have to work and to get jobs, and making it extremely difficult for them to simply perform their sacred duties of working in the Mikdash and of teaching Torah. So Chazal frown upon evading this clearly positive goal by taking the produce in through the roof and exempting ourselves from the requirement of Maaser. A second example of a loophole is the mitzvah of Bechor. The Bechor is the firstborn male offspring of a cow or a sheep belonging to a Jew. It is sanctified, it is kadosh mirachem, from birth, to be brought to the Mikdash as a korban, as a sacrifice. Once the Beis HaMikdash was destroyed, korbanos were no longer brought. However, the kedusha, the sanctity of the firstborn animal, still remained in place. After the animal is born, the animal is supposed to be given to the Kohen. The Kohen waits for the animal to develop a blemish, a mum, and then the Kohen can slaughter the animal. In the meantime, the animal may not be used for avoda, may not be used as a beast of burden. And also, giza is forbidden. You may not shear the animal for wool until it develops a mum, a blemish. Now, this is a sin waiting to happen, because someone may forget and shear the animal for its wool before it develops a blemish. And that's why the Shulchan Aruch in Yeradeya Simon Shin Chaf Sivav rules that nowadays there's a mitzvah to engage in a halachic loophole by transferring ownership of the pregnant animal to a non-Jew before birth and then reacquiring it after birth. Now, why do we recommend this halachic loophole here? So Schachter argues that the goal of the loophole is not to avoid, it's not a bittul mitzvah saseh, it's not to avoid performing a positive mitzvah. After all, we cannot sacrifice the firstborn animal nowadays. Rather, the goal of this halachic loophole is to avoid the possibility that we will violate a prohibition, and that's obviously permitted. Now, Rabbi Bleich argues that this loophole represents a situation in which the fulfillment of the underlying purpose has become impossible because we can't bring korbanos. And the loophole deals with the current reality that there is only a downside with little halakhic upside of not utilizing this loophole. A third example of a halakhic loophole is selling chametz before Pesach to a non-Jew and then repurchasing it after Pesach. Now, some poskim like Rav Soloveitchik frowned upon using this loophole for real chametz. Now, Rav Schachter disagreed with this position. Why? Because for Rav Schachter, using a loophole to avoid the prohibition of owning chametz on Pesach should be acceptable. However, by selling the chametz to a non-Jew instead of destroying it, maybe I'm avoiding the positive mitzvah of tashbisu of destroying the chametz, assuming that you can only fulfill the mitzvah of tashbisu through actually destroying it. Nevertheless, even according to Rav Schachter, if I sell most of my chametz to a non-Jew, as long as I destroy the last bit of my chametz before Pesach, then I would fulfill the mitzvah of tashbisu, and therefore, using the halachic loophole of selling my chametz to a non-Jew should not pose a problem, according to Rav Schachter. Now, Rabbi Bleich believes that the halacha is neutral regarding whether you can sell the chametz to a non-Jew. After all, there's a mitzvah to simply ensure that you don't own chametz on Pesach, and there are at least three equally acceptable ways to accomplish this goal. I could burn or destroy the chametz, I could eat the chametz, or I could give the chametz away. And therefore, there is no prohibition to sell the chametz to a non-Jew before Pesach, and then in a separate transaction, purchase the chametz from the non-Jew after Pesach. A fourth example of a halachic loophole is the heter iska. Now, during the Middle Ages, Jews turned to commercial pursuits, particularly when they were not allowed to own land. So very often, they're in the business of buying and selling goods, and this often required an investment in capital, which few individual Jews possessed. In the 16th century, Rav Mendel Avigdor of Krakow composed the earliest version of the heter iska. The goal is to create a heter iska partnership arrangement as distinct from a loan agreement. Rabbi Bleich argued that in biblical loans, the purpose of the loans, for the most part, was perceived as an act of tzedakah. Indeed, the Torah characterized the recipient of the loan as a poor person. The Torah says, "V'chi yamuch achicha," that your brother becomes poor. Lending someone money was perceived as a higher form of charity because the recipient of the loan receives funds without being deprived of his dignity. The Torah is very clear that the goal is for the poor person to sustain himself. The lender is obligated to help a person in need, but he has no obligation to assist the person in amassing wealth. Therefore, a heter iska for a commercial loan would not violate the spirit of the law and would be an acceptable loophole. According to Rav Shachter, it would seem that using a heter iska would simply avoid the prohibition of lending with interest, which should be acceptable according to his theory of when loopholes are acceptable. However, there also is a Torah obligation of v'chzakta bo v'cheyachicha imach, of supporting the person, of lending the person money so that he can live amongst us. By transforming the loan into the partnership and effectively charging interest through the use of a loophole, are we avoiding the positive mitzvah of lending money without interest? So in response to this, Rabbi Baruch HaLevi Epstein, the Torah Tamima, asserts that in the Middle Ages, when we became a nation that sustained ourselves solely on commerce, then if we would lend people money without interest, then we would not be able to fulfill the Torah's requirement of v'cheyachicha imach, of ensuring that our brother will live amongst us. Why? Because we would not be able to survive financially by making commercial loans without profiting from the loans. And in fact, in the last century, Rav Chaim David HaLevi, the Sephardi chief rabbi of Tel Aviv, argued that I am prohibited to use a heter iska to lend money to a poor person so that I can evade the technical prohibition of charging interest, but I may use a heter iska to lend money for commercial purposes. Now we should note that in ascertaining the legitimacy of a halachic loophole, Rav Shachter is asking a simple question of whether we are simply being mevatel mitzvah aseh, whether we're avoiding a positive mitzvah, or whether we are avoiding an iser, are we avoiding a prohibition. And Rabbi Bleich is trying to ascertain the underlying goals of the mitzvah. And if we can determine that the halachic loophole does not undermine the goals, then we may utilize the loophole. Now, Rav Moshe Lichtenstein made the important point that there is no need to emphasize the danger lying in the attempt to examine each and every mitzvah in light of its reason. For the reasons for the mitzvahs are concealed from us, and how can we know the mind of the Almighty? Many reasons have been offered by many commentators. Who can say which are more correct or less correct? And what are the esoteric that are hidden from us? And how can we rely on such a distinction? Indeed, the concern about error is real and sets a great warning sign before us. Now, at the same time, Rav Moshe Lichtenstein acknowledged that sometimes the underlying reasons for a particular mitzvah are quite evident. For example, regarding the halachic loophole of Prusbul, which allows the lender to avoid releasing debts during the Shemitah year, he explains that, quote, releasing debts was intended to provide a poor person who had been forced to take a loan with the opportunity to open a new page once every 7 years without the burden of past debts preventing him from ever rehabilitating himself. The classic borrower in the Torah is a poor person who needs a longer economic breathing space, and if he fails to rid himself of the burden of debt that is oppressing him, the mitzvah of charity requires that the debt be released. It is clear as day that the Torah would never meant that every 7 years this mitzvah should give a windfall profit to large economic concerns like banks or insurance companies, end quote. And therefore, Rav Moshe Lichtenstein agrees that at times it is justifiable to make the claim that a halachic loophole is legitimate because we are aware that the underlying goal of the mitzvah will not be undone through the use of the loophole. Now, Dr. Ilana Stein-Hain, resident scholar of the Shalom Hartman Institute, wrote a doctoral dissertation for Columbia University on this very topic. And in this paper, she compared two different types of individuals, what she called deontologists and consequentialists. Consequentialists are only concerned with what is right and equitable, whereas deontologists value the law itself and are constrained by the law. Deontologists may not change the law even if they feel that it is equitable to do so. Therefore, in order to create a legal loophole, we need both a legal mechanism plus desirable goals that doing so is equitable. She provides an example to explain the difference between deontologists and consequentialists. Quote, if there is only one respirator available and a terminally ill patient is connected to it, should the hospital administrator demand that the respirator be disconnected and given to a more promising patient? According to consequentialists, the answer is yes. In order to save a person whose chances for survival are great or simply superior to other patients, one may actively remove the necessary life-sustaining resources from someone who shows little or no hope of recovery. For deontologists, however, there is a constraint. Maximizing the good cannot come at the expense of moral behavior. Deontologists instead offer the following scheme. Ordering respirators that must be disconnected for servicing and repair every few weeks may solve the problem. When the respirator connected to the terminally ill patient is disconnected for servicing, the hospital staff would simply not reconnect it to that patient, but would connect it to a more promising patient. For deontologists, the passive process is more acceptable than the active removal of care, and so this may be done in order to maximize positive results. End quote. In applying this to halakhic loopholes, it is important for us to realize that halakhic authorities are deontologists. Even when halakhic authorities desire certain end goals, sometimes they feel constrained by the legal mechanism necessary to create the loophole. Now, how would we apply this analysis of halakhic loopholes to some of the most sensitive issues facing our halakhic community today? So when it comes to issues like mamzerim and kohanim marrying divorcees, I think that there is a clear desire by the YU rabbinic community with which I associate to try to find a way, let's say in the case of the kohen and the divorcee, to annul the first marriage where it is possible, and in the case of the mamzer, to try to ensure that a child should not be considered a mamzer such that he cannot marry anyone. In the case of potential mamzerim, there is a general policy not to investigate when there's a policy then there's a possibility of mamzerut, and not to rely on circumstantial evidence. There is a story with Rav Moshe Feinstein where he was officiating at a wedding. At the last moment, the groom's mother came over to Rav Moshe and said that her son was born from a different man while she was a married woman. Without batting an eyelash, Rav Moshe said to continue the wedding as Eid Echad Eino Neman Bisurin. We do not trust one witness by such cases. However, if someone is found to be a mamzer according to the high evidentiary standard from the Torah, so let's say if there was a real halachic first marriage, there was no get, and then there was a civil divorce, and then the woman remarried in a civil marriage to another husband, and the second marriage produces a child, there may not be much to do despite how tragic the situation is. And I believe the same analysis is true with regard to the Aguna issue. I think there's a clear desire by the rabbinic community with which I associate myself to try to solve the Aguna problem and to use every legitimate legal halachic loophole to accomplish this goal. In fact, in halacha, we try to be as lenient as possible when it comes to Aguna issues. The Gemara states, Mishum Iguna Akilu Bei Rabbanan, that more lenient standards were adapted for the Aguna. In this case, evidentiary standards to determine if a husband died. The trick with many aguna situations is how to dissolve a bona fide marriage. When it comes to Prusbol and Heter Iska, the rabbis created a structure to allow for a loan without interest or without Shemitah invalidating it. So, too, they tried to create a structure of Jewish marriage that won't fundamentally alter the Kedusha and the structure of Jewish marriage and will try to solve the aguna problem. The rabbis came up with the Pridup, which has proven to be successful in solving the problems of Aguna for those couples who signed this agreement. Now, some people have provided other solutions, like annulling any marriage where the husband does not want to give a get. The reasons why many halakhic authorities may not accept some of these solutions is not because they do not desire to end the Aguna suffering, but the limits are based on deontology as to what can be done. Indeed, if they truly believe that some of the proposed solutions do not work halachically, then by allowing these loopholes and allowing the woman to remarry and start a new family, you could potentially create mamzerim. Now, that being said, the aguna issue is not a completely deontological issue, because we could essentially eliminate the halachic institution of marriage and replace it with a type of union modeled after the pilegesh, the concubine, a union of sorts between man and woman that might not require a get to dissolve. The reason why this solution hasn't been seriously considered by the overwhelming majority of poskim is that the overwhelming concern that eliminating the halachic marriage contract would destroy the sanctity of marriage, weaken the strong bond between man and woman created by marriage, and likely lead to a more promiscuous society. As such, creating a halachic loophole to solve the aguna problem by nullifying existing marriages would present an insurmountable deontological issue. Doing away with the marriage contract altogether would present a utilitarian issue, which would be catastrophic to the Jewish notion of family, and as such is not a viable option. Now, when it comes to women's spiritual leadership, my feeling is that the hesitancy among some halachic authorities to use loopholes is not based on deontology, on the technical ability of creating halachic loopholes, but the issue is perhaps more of whether the goals are desirable, and there is an ongoing halachic conversation about this issue. The Rambam holds that the prohibition of Sarara applies not just to female monarchs, but to all positions of authority, and a rabbi would be included in this prohibition. However, other Rishonim disagree with the Rambam, and in practice, women do have certain positions of authority in other areas of life that seem to be acceptable in the Orthodox community. The consensus of Rishonim seems to be that women cannot be judges at the same time. In many communities, women do many of the same things that a shul rabbi does. It would seem to me that for a number of halachic authorities, the question of the parameters of women's spiritual leadership does not stem from a deontologist perspective, that there is no way that we can create a loophole to allow for increased spiritual leadership on the part of women. Rather, it seems that the debate relates to the consequentialist issue, the desirability of such a position in Jewish communal life. Very often, the discussion regarding certain aspects of women's spiritual leadership revolves around the question of halachic ethos, which to me is a question of meta-halacha and not necessarily pure halacha. I think that the halachic authorities in my camp may be divided on this issue. The needle has moved in the past number of years to include yoatzot halacha, for example, and the discussion to expand women's spiritual leadership roles may continue in this vein in a way that it cannot, let's say, when it comes to permitting mamzerim to marry. Hopefully, we can appreciate some of the variables that go into the decisions about when to create halachic loopholes and when not to create them, and perhaps what future solutions may look like in dealing with some of these challenging situations. For example, maybe new creative halachic loopholes might be discovered to deal with aguna situations when a couple didn't sign a halachic prenup. Maybe certain attitudes about the desirability of certain religious behavior and practices may change regarding women's spiritual leadership as a result of continued conversations between our community and halachic authorities, like the shift that occurred in our community regarding yoatzot halacha. I do not know, but only time will tell.